that there will be a massive global nuclear war. That is called lateral proliferation, because every country that buys a nuclear power plant can extract material from it called plutonium, which is raw material for atomic bombs, and they can make atomic bombs too, like India did 2 years ago when Canada sold her a reactor and she made an atomic bomb. Now Pakistan, who considers she's India's enemy, is now buying a nuclear reactor and a reprocessing plant to make her own bomb. Taiwan is buying one, South Korea, Brazil, Argentina. Idi Amin says that he will have an atomic bomb in a couple of years. It's said that Israel has stolen enough material from this country to make 15 to 20 atomic bombs. And there's no doubt that the more countries that obtain atomic bombs, the more chance there is that the great powers will be brought into direct confrontation by a small nuclear war somewhere in the world. Irradiate the men so that they survive for 2 weeks to fight before they get their radiation illness. You must irradiate them so intensively that they will die of what is called the acute encephalopathic syndrome. That means the brain cells will be so damaged they swell up inside the skull, increasing the pressure inside the skull. And this produces symptoms such as stupor, delirium, ataxia, they can't walk straight, fever. Then they have a period of lucidity before they die. Can you imagine a more diabolical way that man could have devised to kill his fellow brother? Where are we now in the world? What on earth are we doing? This country has enough weapons to overkill Russia several times. Russia has enough to overkill this country several times. Within half an hour. Einstein said when he discovered the theory of relativity, "I wish I'd been a locksmith," because he predicted what man would do with the atom, and he's done it with a vengeance. The man in charge of the black button, the black box, 2 years ago in this country was not exactly stable. In fact, he had the black box removed from him several weeks before he resigned because they considered he wasn't stable enough to have it in his possession. The stress of the presidency is so great now that how can one man remain stable? None of us are completely sane and stable all our lives. Leonid Brezhnev has been sick and has been treated with cortisone, a good drug, but occasionally it produces acute psychosis. We are in the hands of mere mortals. We are, at this point in time, the curators of life on earth. We hold it in the palm of our hand. How did we get to this point in time? I think from a psychiatric point of view, most of us deny our own death. It's too scary to think about. I think particularly on the whole, males are more effective at doing this than females, and I am speaking to a female audience. Most of the politicians in the world are males. Have any of those men ever seen a child come into a hospital, age 12, a beautiful, healthy boy, top of his class, good at sports, with a few bruises on his body? He has a blood picture done. He's got leukemia. Nobody tells him. They put him in an isolated room, and his parents can only visit him if they wear a gown and a mask. He has some funny tasting medicine which makes him feel sick. He lives in a state of fear for 2 weeks till suddenly he dies of massive hemorrhage from every orifice. Have any of these politicians ever seen that? Have any of them supported those parents in their grief? Do they know what death means? They obviously don't. Because if they did, how could they talk about limited nuclear war? And how could they talk about MAD, mutually assured destruction? We, women, are the civilizers of the world. If you were a psychiatrist sitting on Mars now, looking down at the Earth, you'd say the Earth was being run by lunatics. They are professional killers, but by God, they're good at it. And the more nuclear weapons that are made, the more chance there is soon that they will be wiped out. Our only chance of survival is to eliminate every single nuclear weapon on this earth. I see no good reason why we as women and mothers should be so concerned about immunizing our children against disease, giving good food, love, and a good education when they may have no future. As I said, women are the civilizers of the human race. We understand the genesis of life. We carry it in our bellies. We never forget. We care about our children. We won the right to vote years ago, but we've stood back and allowed the male politicians to rush like lemmings towards virtually assured destruction. We must use our political force to save the world for our children and descendants. More than half the adults in the world are women. Let us rise up and eliminate all nuclear weapons on Earth. This is the ultimate in preventative medicine. This must be the universal goal for all women in all countries of the world.
Absolutely beautiful, and I think it does give us some real food for thought that all these wonderful things that are being done to protect women and children may really not be what we want. I think that was a very excellent presentation. Our next panelist is Dr. Ann Kahn, who is the head of the International Social Impact Section of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Previously, she was a research fellow at the Harvard University Arms Control Program. And we welcome you.
Thank you very much, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder and Congresswoman Yvonne Burke. And I welcome Congressman Brown out there. When we originally planned this panel, I was scheduled to go first. And Randall Forsberg said no, she didn't wish to follow Helen. I now know why she didn't want to do so. Each of us this morning is addressing really a different aspect of the arms race. But in essence, I think we're really agreed on the one message that we hope to get across to you. And that is that we are unified in our belief that the arms race is of overriding importance and that it's critical that women get involved in national discussions of national security. That in order to get involved, you have to be informed. So each of us in our own way, some more passionately and some perhaps less passionately, but intensely felt in any case, are trying in essence to give you a cram course this morning that in the hopes that we will stir you to go out and become as actively involved in discussions and persuasions of national security and arms control issues as you are in the environment or school or local politics or anything else. I feel very strongly that national security is not a technical issue primarily. It is not something that should be left to theoretical physicists or that it can only be understood by theoretical physicists. National security and arms control policies affects each and every one of us in very profound and fundamental ways, and therefore we owe it to ourselves to be as involved and informed in these matters as we are in any others. And one of the most fundamental ways in which we're in which the arms race affects us directly is in economic ways. National decisions on newer and bigger weapon systems or on arms control measures directly affect the pocketbook of every one of us. For example, the B-1 plane, that airplane that was recently canceled by President Carter, was going to cost over $100 million per plane, and the Air Force wanted to build 244 of them. There are really two ways in which nations like the United States can reduce their military expenditures. One is by unilateral actions, by national initiatives like President Carter's decision not to build 244 B-1 bombs, or by negotiated arms control agreements. An example of the economic impact of a negotiated arms control agreement was the ABM Treaty of 1972, where the United States and the Soviet Union each agreed that they would only build two of the anti-ballistic missile defenses, which Randy told you wouldn't have worked in any case, and that number was later changed to only one in each country. The studies that have been done of the amount of money saved by that negotiated treaty range as high as $11 billion that were not spent because we and the Soviet Union came to an agreement about it. As we talk about the economic aspects of the arms race, I think it's important to keep in mind that the United States is not the only large military spender in the world. The Soviet Union, according to most reliable estimates, spends just about as much as we do. We each spend more than $100 billion a year on defense or on military expenditures. By comparison, the People's Republic of China, the third largest military spender, spends about $33 billion, and other countries like West Germany and France lag far behind, spending a mere, if you'll pardon the expression, $12 or $15 billion. Together, as you can see from the chart over there, the United States and the Soviet Union account for more than one-half of the world's total military expenditures. Even though Pat Schroeder tried to give us a good sense of what $1 billion would mean, I think there's another way of looking at it. In 1976, it's estimated that total world military expenditures were about $400 billion. What that means is that the world in that 1 year spent on military expenditures, that is equivalent to $400 spent every single minute since Mary gave birth to Jesus Christ. That's what $400 billion is. $400 every minute since Christ was born. If you accept my definition of national security as dependent upon internal stability and justice and equality, then it is apparent that military expenditures do not necessarily buy you national security. President Carter recently commented on the fact that the world today spends more than 60 times as much equipping each soldier as educating each child. The world's budget for military research is more than six times its budget for energy research. Developed nations spend 20 times more for their military programs than they do on economic assistance to developing countries. And the equivalent of a full year's budget for the UN and its agencies is spent in 2 days on arms. Underneath all of these statistics, there is a widespread perception that military spending is good for the economy. Many Americans believe that military spending creates jobs, cures recessions, and that arms exports help our sagging balance of payments. As the economist John Kenneth Galbraith once put it, to talk about this publicly is never thought permissible. To say that the arms race is good because it sustains income and employment, adds usefully to innovation and gross national product, verges on the obscene. Galbraith goes on to say, but it would greatly clarify our political discussion if economic interests could be openly recognized and discussed. So let's look together for a few minutes at the facts. What do we and don't we know about military spending and the economy? How does it affect jobs and the balance of payments? There is a widespread belief in the United States, which is exemplified on the right by John Connolly, who defended the bailout loan to Lockheed in 1971 by saying it would provide employment for 31,000 people throughout the country. And ranging over to Tom Hayden on the political left, who in 1976 said, "I don't believe that any defense contract ought to be cut in the face of mass unemployment." Despite these statements, the studies of number of jobs created by various government programs are in general agreement on one point. Military spending is one of the least effective ways to create jobs. This shouldn't be surprising when we stop to think about it. Defense contractors are usually the highest paying employers in their communities, and defense firms have a disproportionately higher share of highly paid engineers and scientists compared to non-defense firms. And in addition, defense industry is capital intensive because it utilizes very expensive equipment and materials. So if the primary objective of the federal government were to generate employment, it would create the maximum number of jobs by employing lots of low-paid people in service activities and not through defense contracts. Job creation is clearly a weak argument for military spending. As for the balance of payments argument, any goods that the United States or any other country exports help the balance of payments. Civilian goods do this just as well as military goods. In fact, this administration is committed to reducing our arms sales abroad, regardless of balance of payments considerations. And this brings me to the question of alternatives. What alternatives are there to the present scheme of things? Is it possible to design a defense policy which permits and even encourages a national defense industry which is fully responsive to America's legitimate defense needs, and yet have it be able to expand or contract without hurting working people? More and more people are coming to the realization that we need to develop improved planning mechanisms to facilitate ebbs and flows in defense procurement. Several bills are now before Congress which deal with the issue of economic conversion. And within the executive branch, too, there is a growing awareness of our need to deal with that issue more adequately. I encourage each of you to think about the problems and what solutions you would propose. How can we convert our defense industry or a portion of it to civilian production? How about requiring defense contractors to pay a percentage of their defense contracts into a government-operated trust fund and then use the proceeds of that to assist workers who could lose their jobs because of defense cutbacks? Or you might consider requiring several years of advance notification if a defense plant was going to close down, so that you would give the workers and the community leaders adequate preparation to prepare to retrain the workers and provide for other jobs for them. Or how about for providing for readjustment assistance, which includes the retraining of workers who are affected by the termination of major defense contracts, or providing tax incentives to industry to hire such retrained defense workers. I want to encourage you not only to think about this important subject of economic conversion, but on the broader subject of arms control in general. For in order to realize any significant reductions in military budgets, the political climate in the United States is going to have to be such that both unilateral and negotiated arms control agreements are supported by the widest possible segment of public opinion. And that is where we most need your help. We need you to be knowledgeable about these issues. We need you to understand what the acronyms of SALT and MBFR that Pat Schroeder mentioned are all about. We need you to be willing to get involved in these issues, and together we hopefully can leave a peaceful and secure legacy to our children and to our children's children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ann. I noticed sitting behind Congressman Brown, we now have Bella Abzug, one of our real leaders in this area. I just have to take 2 minutes to share a story because Bella hasn't heard this either. She's been getting a lot of flack down the street, and she's one of my heroes, and I want to tell you how you impacted on his 7-year-old's life, Bella. This summer we had my daughter, and we were traveling in Turkey. She's 7 years old, and she adores Bella. We were in a mosque in Turkey, and the Turkish guide was saying, women are not to come to the mosque to pray, but if they insist on coming to the mosque to pray, they remain behind the bar. As we were walking out, my young daughter looked up at the Turkish guide and said, you Turks are awfully lucky that Bella Abzug isn't Turkish, because she wouldn't take that. That, to me, is a great tribute that a 7-year-old has been able to perceive that, by golly, in America, she's got a spokesman and nobody put that down. So I think that's wonderful. We have our next panelist, who's a very distinguished person, too, Dr. Betty Lawl, who's a professor at New York State School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. She's been a frequent participant at the U.S.-Russian informal discussions on disarmament at PUG, Washington. And I think that this is a very, this is a very, very prestigious group that gets together. And so we're honored to have her here since she's been a participant in that very prestigious group. Thank you.
Thank you. Congresswoman Schroeder, Congressman Burke, Congressman Brown, Bella, friends. My assignment on this panel is how do we get going with real disarmament? We have heard from Randy about the buildup of forces on both sides. We've heard from Helen about the dangers of nuclear war. And we've heard from Ann about the huge waste of funds and resources that are put for armaments. Some argue that short of a world war, there is no way to persuade the men, mostly, who make decisions concerning national security to disarm rapidly. Distrust is still a cornerstone of international relations. Bureaucracies are loath to change. And governments fear that rapid disarmament will unleash new forces in the world, causing uncertainties with destabilizing consequences. And many governments are apprehensive about their internal affairs and lack of tranquility among their citizens, many of whom live under conditions of suppression, hunger, and terrible inflation. National leaders seek stability. Change is anathema. These are realities. Realism, however, is not the opposite of idealism. Stating realities only provides the framework for our goal and enhances our determination to achieve results. To move toward comprehensive, general, and complete disarmament in a world fraught with hostility as well as timidity requires a concept and a plan. It demands conviction and perseverance as well as patience and skill. The plan I present to you has 3 parts covering 1, disarmament of strategic vehicles, that is, the land-based intercontinental missiles, the submarine-launched missiles, and the long-range bombers. 2, reduction of nuclear warheads, nuclear bombs, and other nuclear explosives. And 3, limitations of conventional armaments production and sales. To reduce strategic arms, we must build upon the agreements reached between the United States and the Soviet Union at the strategic arms limitation talks. These 2 countries have made to date definite but very modest tentative agreements to limit the number of missiles and bombers capable of delivering nuclear weapons on each other's territory from thousands of miles away. The total number of vehicles to be retained in the SALT II agreement somewhat exceeds 2,000, and over half of these would be equipped with multiple nuclear warheads independently targeted. This is over 10 times what would be needed to deter the other side from initiating an aggression in a first strike attack. These conclusions, still valid, are based on an important paper prepared some years ago for President Kennedy and which has now been released. Thus, our first immediate objective should be, at the very least, an agreement to reduce this 2,000 figure by half. In addition, the development and production of new strategic weapon systems must stop. The goal of disarmament and arms control is not only to reduce the existing implements of war, it is to do something about the new weapons on the production line, and it is to release resources. The new very large missiles of the Soviet Union, the projected development of a mobile MX missile, and the highly adaptable cruise missile of the United States are even more dangerous than what both sides have now and ought to be abandoned. Other new strategic systems also should be stopped. But it is the momentum of the arms race that propels us constantly forward. It is necessary for us to recognize that the United States, as the leader in the race, should lead in showing restraint in the rate at which we develop and produce new weapons. Let us argue with military officers, the defense planners, the industry executives and lobbyists, and their supporters in the Congress. Of the $13 billion we will be spending this fiscal year for strategic weapons, we can take a few billion from this amount and call on the Soviet Union to join us in a downward trend in the building of weaponry. We have so many more weapons than we need to deter the Soviet Union from attacking us. We can safely afford to show this kind of restraint and take this kind of initiative. I dwell on this strategic arms race for three reasons. First, because it is the most dangerous. These weapons, as we have already heard, will cause millions of deaths once they are used. Secondly, the reduction of strategic weapons and the curtailment of the development and production of new ones can be observed, and thus an essential element of arms control and disarmament, namely the verification of agreements and mutual restraints, will be satisfied. And third, because these weapons can be reduced by the United States and the Soviet Union acting alone. No other country has such quantities of these weapons. Now I come to a second part of the plan, some measures to reduce and achieve disarmament of nuclear warheads, bombs, and other nuclear explosives. One measure is that the United States and the Soviet Union should stop production of fissionable materials for weapons purposes, for nuclear weapons. Not only will this foreclose adding to the stockpiles of warheads for strategic delivery vehicles, but it would also help to stop the accumulation of tactical or small nuclear weapons, such as the neutron bomb, which will make nuclear war more likely. This step also can be verified without much intrusion into the territory of the Soviet Union. Second measure is to reduce the nuclear weapon stockpiles of the United States and the Soviet Union. These number over 50,000 for the two countries, with the United States having a substantial lead. 1,000 weapons, 4,000, or 10,000 as a beginning can be deposited at an agreed location where observers can check their dismantling. It will not be easy to reprocess and find alternative uses and safe storage places for so much nuclear material. To undo what we have made in over 30 years can consume the ingenuity of some of the scientists and engineers who built these weapons in the past. The United States... The United States has rightly invested enormous efforts to persuade other countries not to go nuclear, not to make even a single or a few nuclear bombs. How can we convince these nations when our own stockpiles remain intact with new additions every year? Our position is inconsistent, and some of the world leaders may think it arrogant. A third measure toward nuclear disarmament is to stop nuclear testing. The Soviet Union and the United States have been negotiating to achieve this single, relatively simple act for 20 years. Six American presidents, three Republicans and three Democrats, and two Soviet rulers have failed to agree to stop testing. Once again, we can state with assurance that the cessation of nuclear testing can be verified by using national instruments to look into the Soviet Union and record any cheating that would be significant. Another measure to move us toward nuclear disarmament should be an agreement among all five of the nuclear weapons powers not to use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states, particularly those without nuclear weapons or troops of a nuclear weapons power on their territory.